I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Well, good evening, and welcome to this very special edition of Leaving Hillsong Theatre. This is a rather unusual edition because during the past week, the son of the founder, Frank Houston, Brian Houston, has been in court being tried for the offence of concealing a serious indictable offence, which was covered in an earlier episode. We went through a lot of that process. Now, my dear friend Jake Elliott, who is running an account on Instagram called The Framework, @_framework0, where work should be that O there. We attended every day of court this week, and yesterday we sat down and compared notes. Jake was working mostly from an iPad. He was typing. I've got handwritten notes I was scribbling frantically. Neither of us are legally trained. However, I have got some legal support on the side, and my understanding is that this is a public gallery and we are allowed to discuss what we saw in the witness box and report it outside, or it wouldn't be public. We've kept away from speculations or personal opinions as far as possible, and so all we are seeking to do is report what took place in the courtroom this week, because the mainstream media has really only stuck to the kind of sensationalist headlines a lot of the time, and much of that stuff actually came out in the Royal Commission in 2014, so it's not very useful for people who really want to know how a court matter like this unfolds. Please go easy on us. This is not perfect, but I believe it's more than you're going to get, like, well, almost anywhere else. It's a small courtroom. There's not many people there, but there's us. This episode will go through day one and some of day two of the last 5 days. So thank you so much for joining Jake Elliott and me for part one of the court case. I think it would be a good idea to set a bit of a scene for people who aren't actual local Sydneysiders before we start as to what this court situation is like. Brian Houston is being tried in the centre of Sydney, in the Central Business District, in a court that's usually used for, you know, much more serious matters. It's an old department store from, I don't know, the 50s or 60s, and it's a very fancy schmancy building. It's right opposite a
Hyde Park, which is this park in the centre of Sydney. And, you know, there's a lot of high profile cases that are tried there, but they're usually at a higher level. So, you know, it's got the grand stairs and you walk in and then there's all the security and the beeping and the put your bag down and stuff and, you know, fancy lights and great lighting and lifts and lawyers and all this important stuff. And when you get in the lift and the elevator to go up to the local court section, I was thinking, Jake, I don't know what you think, like into like a waiting room that's probably the size of an average living room. Yeah. Like, there's four rows of chairs for people to sit in. So you then, there's like quite a narrow corridor at the end of that. And to the left is another long, narrow corridor. And
it feels like you're walking a labyrinth somewhere.
Well, it's just that, you know, it's so sort of surreal because mm-hmm. to the left there are, I think, you know, three courts because it's a local court. It's for driving or swearing or, you know, much more, you know, not certainly not high-profile cases. So when you go in, there's a magistrate out the front who presiding. There's some court people that, you know, place for the defence, place for the prosecution there. And then there's two rows. What do you think, Jake? Maybe 30 seats there?
There's less than 30 seats. I'd say probably about 20 to 25.
So, I mean, it's...
Yeah.
I mean, we were expecting, I guess, maybe we live in a bubble. We were expecting a lot more sort of a competition for seats, I guess. And it didn't happen to the point where... By the end of Friday, you know, there were spare seats available.
Yeah, I was really confused with the layout myself. I walked in, it's very grandiose downstairs. Then you go up into these lifts and it's minimalistic, neutral environment, very boring. You walk into this really small room and I was like, oh, there aren't that many seats. So I was like, surprised as you. It was quite a surreal jump of room design.
So, you know, as Drap said to me, you know, is there a place for the bride and a place for the groom's guests? And like, there kind of is, you know, there's people for the defence on the left there and various people on the right who, I mean, we started on Monday morning. There was me up against the wall trying to be inconspicuous, me on the left in the back sitting next to Jake. And then who turned out to be Brian's brother, then his sister, and Bobby and Brian Houston. And it's like, it was just,
together.
many a letter and phone call has been made and many a dollar has been donated for that kind of an opportunity. And there we were. Now, I believe wholeheartedly that everybody deserves the respect of the court process to go through. So, you know, there's no communications or, well, Ben, a little bit, we'll talk about that later, but the court man goes like, and then everybody stands up or rise and we do this bowing thing and everyone sits down and there you are. You and 20.
Officially started.
So.
It was surreal. It was really surreal.
Grey, blue. Everything's grey, blue. That bluey grey colour.
Yeah, all that I know is designed to not kind of like stimulate or, you know, be distracting. There's a lot of there's elements when it comes to designing rooms like that so that, because colour design actually plays a massive factor in the way people think, operate and feel. So there's all that's intentional. And so it was very quite humbling, sobering, but there was an element of just surrealism. It was very surreal, street and style. If you were the first one there, it's quite an intimidating place, but the more people come into that place, it's a bit more friendly. But whenever it was just like him or Bobby or people on his side there, it was just a bit more intimidating because of the suits as well. There was a bit more colour coming in with like with journalists wearing different colours, and it kind of just helped lighten the mood a bit, I think, with a bit more of a colourful personalities colorful shirts and stuff like that coming into the scene, it suddenly made the experience a bit more eclectic and a bit more normal rather than this clinical environment.
I mean, I was a part of the church that became Hillsong, so I joined with my family when I was 14. So it's not a thing for me to see Brian, because I remember him from when I was 14 and he, I think, was 32 and Pat Mussini was 28 and whatever. And my dad was a friend and an advisor to these guys, so I just kind of see them through those eyes. And it's, yeah, and I know that, well, you know, when they see me, they don't, you know, they probably see some kids. So it's kind of not that big a deal, but it's obviously a very big deal. You know, I mean, there's a very powerful, influential man, and this is a very serious case. What were you saying before? The last time you saw Brian, Jake, was...
Oh, the last time I saw Brian was at my uncle's funeral. I wasn't expecting him to see him there. So it's quite been quite surreal with me and my experience with Brian since leading Hillsong and the CLC movement. It was first time really was the Royal Commission. Second time was going back to the Royal Commission, summoning, seeing him there, and then seeing him at my uncle's funeral. There are unusual places to meet.
I know he knows my face, and my mug is something that people don't forget. I mean, do you think he's recognizing? Do they know you when they see you?
Well, that's what's weird. I don't think he understands why I'm going to these things, and I didn't understand why really he would want to go to my uncle's funeral, but it kind of makes sense. So when I saw him this time, it was like...
But does he know who you are? Like, would he know your face?
Only from those experiences, yes, maybe.
Okay. No, I mean, yeah. I don't, you know, remember how much time you actually...
We've never really talked, but because there's just been an air of intimidation because of the people he chooses to hang around with suits on. But I don't feel comfortable having a conversation with him because of those past experiences where he's got his elders and board members or people with suits just...
Yeah.
It's been quite intimidating. And there was none of that. It was much more sobering and much more... Really, it was just him and Bobby.
We were at the Royal Commission together, and, you know, he was flanked by about six men at all times in, you know, from my memory, they were sort of wearing all black, you know, Joel LaBelle following him around like that. And he was certainly not alone at any point. And this is a very different setup. All right, so day one was opening statements from the prosecution and the defence.
I really had difficulty following that because I didn't find Bolton that engaging, and I had difficulty following Bolton's logic. What's interesting is that I found myself explaining a lot to the people because they were just hearing stuff that they couldn't make a connection because it wasn't the proper timeline to follow up this at this point, the beginning. So I had difficulty trying to listen because I had reporters going, oh, what's this and what's that? Why are they saying this? And I found myself quietly talking and making notes to them so they understood why things were being said straight off the bat, because it was so hard to follow.
The public prosecutor is, I think that's a Scottish accent he has there. He's called Gareth Harrison, and the defence is called Philip Bolton, and he's a what we call a senior counsel, so out of the wig wearers that we discussed when they're very good. No, but what is higher, Queen's Counsel or Senior Counsel? It doesn't matter. Anyway, this man is a high-profile barrister. He would be earning a lot of money, probably $10,000 a day for doing the job that he's doing. He's bald and he's got his ears that stick out. And he's, you know, pretty thorough and interesting to watch. It's just such an interesting performance, the whole thing. We watched these opening statements. It's one count of concealing a serious indictable offence that the accused knew that it was a offence, that the accused knew he had material that could assist in the prosecution of Frank Houston, and that the accused failed without good reasonable excuse to bring that to the police. So the prosecution says that there's no dispute of element one. Sorry, my notes are not going to be perfect here. There's no dispute of element one that Frank Houston abused Brett Sengstock. There's no dispute of element three, that the accused knew that he had information that would assist police. So it's elements two and four, which are, did he know he was supposed to report, and did he have a reasonable excuse not to do so? Prosecution says he, the accused believed that the man was in his 30s and didn't want it reported. That could be one defence.
I've got a quote from Bolton saying people can have different ideas and how to respond. So he was really looking at, in his defence, to say anyone, because how subjective it was and how they perceive the events, anyone was in a position to report Frank.
It was a very broad kind of statement. Okay.
Yep, after the break, says Dr. the stand.
So, I mean, it was just so unexpected. Don't you think it was like just so unexpected, Jake? Like, we were not expecting to see Frank Houston's most public victim, Brett Sangstock, take the stand on day one.
That was pretty emotional, to tell you the truth.
But day one, Brett had taken one of the Royal Commission pseudonyms during the Royal Commission in 2014. He's known in a lot of documentation as AHA, and he kept his anonymity for a long time and went public a few years ago. So, you know, it's been an intense journey for him and watching him. And he took the stand again to recount what had happened to him the night before his 8th birthday, when he was first assaulted by Frank. It turns out his father was an osteopath and Frank liked those treatments, and the family were very heavily involved in the church, the local church, and Frank would come to visit from New Zealand and he would stay with the Sangstock family. And you know, what became more public knowledge in this testimony was that Brett's father was a very violent man. And so it really hit me that this, you know, this travelling pastor would have seen a battered child and seen that vulnerability. And he talked about being, you know, he talked about being controlled by Frank and by the church and by his family and by the religion from the time. Yeah, I mean, the abuse continued from when he was 7 up until he was 16. And do you want to jump in on this one? Or
I do, and forgive me if I'm a bit emotional about it, because it was such a terrible story. I'd never understood from the Royal Commission why that Bible was brought up. And he,
what story?
About the Bible. So Brent painted the scene when he took the stand, and I've got a quote here, and I remember him saying it. It's so weird watching someone say this. Frank Houston was the first, that was the first night he raped me. It was like, wow. It was so.
Yeah, it's horrible. It's horrible
seeing someone who's in his 60s say something like that. And he painted a picture that because of that Bible. So that's why it was such a significant icon to him. Because that time of the first night that. It's around his birthday as well. What a birthday present to receive. It was context just makes it even worse.
And then Frank gave him a pile of 1 and 2 cent pieces, and he said that was the end of it.
Quote, Frank Houston's signature was on the Bible, dropped 1 or 2 cents into my hands, and that was it. Close quote. Whew.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. He took a break, sort of, I guess, a quarter of the way into his testimony. It's quite an emotionless kind of courtroom setting. You know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how courts can be more soothing, but it's so, I don't know, clinical, I guess, in a way. So he had a bit of a break, and then he talked a bit about, well, you know, the disclosure. So he had gone off the rails or something, you know, whatever the old saying was, and his mother had suggested he go to, of all people, to go to Frank Houston for counselling, because he was such a great pastor. And during that counselling session, you know, Frank attempted to sexually assault him. I don't think the details are necessary. Brett ran out and got into the car with his mother.
Yeah. I got a quote from why she did that. And it was from Brett. We were so heavily involved, my friends, my family. We were so indoctrinated into this dot, dot, dot. And he was talking about this entire CLC revival stuff that was going on in the 70s and 80s around Frank. So that's why it looks like his mother did send him to Frank, because it's like, well, who else, who better than Frank himself?
Yep. As, you know, essentially his mother, when he said, look, I can't go back to that counselling session, Frank's been molesting me for years.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
His mother's response was, you know, don't you dare think about taking a brother to court. Don't you even consider being responsible for sending people to hell. And then that for the bulk of his life was pretty much, that was the end of that conversation, although there's been a bit of conjecture about that in court. But essentially Brett, you know, gave testimony that he was way too ashamed, he was way too horrified by what had happened to him to report it to anybody, to tell anybody at all. So this man carried this for a whole bunch of years, and then one day his mother Rose was at a crusade. And it's funny, isn't it, Jake, like we're watching these terms getting explained. They were for the good old secular courts, people have to get definitions of altar calls and crusades and stuff. Rose is so moved by Kevin Mudford, affectionately known as Mad Dog Mudford. He's this traveling evangelist. He sets up a tent, he throws on the drama, he discloses abuse of his own, I think. And Rose, Brett's mother, is so overwhelmed by this story that she then tells Mudford, I think, first, doesn't she, that her son was abused by Frank.
Yep.
Or does she tell Barbara Taylor, the pastor who runs the church?
So a bit about Mad Dog Mudford. He's a biker, that's all. That's why he had that name.
I mean, I don't know that it even necessarily matters, but just...
So from what I understood from how Brett's mother responded, she apparently stood up, said a bit to everyone about this.
Okay.
And then from what I gathered, she then walked out and disclosed to Mudford more privately the details of what happened. So sometimes when it comes to an altar call or an event like this, you say what's right to say face in front of everyone, but then after this service, you'll confide in your pastor, or you'll confide in the person who just spoke, going, can you please pray for me for healing, or can you please help me with this?
Yeah.
I really need this disclosure, what I can do. My soul is really upset. She would have done something to that extent.
If you're going to put your hand up for something embarrassing, then you're not going to really, like, tell the whole room what you're going through. You'll have a confidential story later. Okay, so then Mudford.
It's a bit more controversial than that, because you can't just say, oh, this male guy did this to my male son because of the stigma of homosexuality. Like, that's a big deal. That is a huge deal, having that stigma attached to you as a mother. Like, there is no way you're going to disclose that publicly.
Yeah. So then pretty quickly, Kevin Mad Dog Mudford goes to tell Pastor Barbara Taylor, who is running a church of, I don't know, 100 people, I think she said, in a small suburb an hour west of Sydney. And it just so happens that her late husband, which is why she was a pastor now, the husband dies in 1977. She takes over this small church. Her husband's sister's sister-in-law happens to be Brett's mother. So Barbara Taylor pretty quickly finds out what's going on. Now, what happens next is up for debate. We've heard different evidence, but the next day, Kevin Mudford takes it upon himself to go around to Brett's house to talk about these allegations. When he goes to the house, Brett's testimony is that Kevin Mudford is very angry with him. Barbara Taylor turns up, you know, 5 minutes later. Brett says that, Brett testifies that Kevin tried to barge into his house. He's saying things like, Frank would never do that. He's a good man. Why are you trying to cause these problems? Brett's very upset. He wasn't expecting, I think it was a Sunday morning. I don't think he was expecting these people.
It was a Sunday morning, yes.
Yeah, he hadn't known the disclosure had taken place by his mother. He felt really, you know, thrown off by that. And, you know, he hears these people yelling at you now. Barbara Taylor disputed that version, didn't she?
I think Brett said that Barbara Taylor was yelling as well. Both of them were yelling.
And I think Pastor Taylor disputed that. So,
and Brett did say something about having a black belt at that time.
Well, he says Mudford was furious. Frank would never do that. We need to keep it in-house, let the church deal with it. And then in late 1988-99.
So I want to stress that Brett Zemstock said he only told his mother back in the 80s once about that because he didn't know how to approach it because she just went off at him. She was really angry hearing this revelation that Frank would do something like that to him. So he said that he didn't bring it up with her again.
You know, he carried that stuff for a long time. It's been a series of courageous events for Brett and attempts to fix things and those attempts being derailed. But, yeah, that's another story.
And the reason why that's important was because in 1994, Bolton started really going after Brett's testimony. So Bolton was reading out some diary entries of his mother in 1994, where apparently this was raised again without Brett's knowledge. It seemed to be a point of contention, and it was seemed to be really affecting Brett on the stand. So Bolton literally was really at this point getting Brett worked up about these diary accounts of his mother being read out. No one could read them in the court case, so it was firsthand new information for all of us. But apparently, in 1994. His mother and himself had another massive fight, and she was writing him the notes how, why didn't I know about this, about the nature of it as well. I don't know. I think it's just really important to stress that, because that was a good while.
And those diaries can't be found in the Zemstock family. So it speaks to this nobody knew until 1998.
I've got a reasonable quote here. It's not a direct quote, but it was something that he did say. When Bolton asked AHA, if you asked your mother, and he said, I did tell my mother, she told me to see counselling. I went to Frank. She didn't say anything. We got home. She finally said, I need to shut up, and that she did not want to be responsible for sending anyone to hell.
So somewhere in late 1998, early 99, Frank Houston starts calling Brett and, Brett starts receiving, according to his testimony, a number of calls from Frank telling him that he wouldn't need to go public with this. No one's going to believe you anyway, at one point he said. And Frank wanted forgiveness. Frank was getting old and, you know, he knew he was going to fall off his perch soon. And his story, and, you know, a lot of this was covered in the Royal Commission.
Yeah.
It's evidence, you know, a lot of this isn't necessarily new before the courts, but it has been spoken about under oath again by Brett again, albeit that he is using his name now. Frank pretty much badgered Brett into meeting with him and accepting money. And then Brett eventually agreed to meet with Frank at Redfern Station in Sydney. But when he saw the green Jaguar drive up with the number plate CLC777, it made him feel too sick and he couldn't go through with the meeting.
Yep.
There were more calls between us, and he was offered $2,000 a month by Frank for the rest of Frank's life or his life or somebody's. And then we jumped to an infamous meeting at a McDonald's in a suburb, I guess, probably 15 minutes away from Hillsong headquarters, It's called Thornlea, and it's, wouldn't have taken them too long to drive from the Hills Christian Life Centre over to Thornlea McDonald's. Oh. It was the same green Jag that was there when Brett says he turned up, and Frank was there with another man that he didn't know at the time. And it's
on Elder, Nabi Saleh.
It was, in fact, it was Nabi Saleh, who was the part owner of the Gloria Jean's coffee chain back in the day, and a close friend and elder and director and whatever else at Hillsong. You got the good car parks, that's for sure, for the Jag. And it was there, wasn't it, Jake, that, you know, I've got this in capitals in my notebook. I was paid money for my silence, I have no doubt at all, says Brett.
Yeah, absolutely. It was an incredibly traumatic experience, not just for AHA, Brett and stuff, but also for Frank Easton. It was awful hearing that recount again in court. Well, it didn't benefit anyone, that meeting. It was stressful. Frank Houston was apparently going, where's this paper? Where's this paper? I can't find it. And he was getting upset. There was meant to be a document that was meant to be brought. And Frank was stressed out, going, where is it? Which is why they ended up signing the napkin.
In this meeting, I mean, this just blows me away. It reminds me of that scene with Samuel L. Jackson, John Travolta in Pulp Fiction, where they're going over to shoot those guys in the apartment, and they have this long conversation about a burger, and it's like, who could eat? And who would eat, like, just during a meeting of that seriousness where you're driving the old man head pastor to meet with his child sexual assault victim, and you've decided to get a quarter pound of value meal while you're there? Like, what? So Brett turns up, decides to go through with it, and they're sitting there, and he says, you know, Nabi was eating and he had a napkin, and so he said, sign here and keep it. This is between us. And the prosecution said, you know, how did you feel? He said, I was overwhelmed. I was sitting across from my rapist.
Like, just common sense. If you knew the nature of that meeting, there's no way you'd be eating a burger. But if you wasn't told about the nature of that meeting, you'd go, oh, okay, it's just a conversation. So, I don't know. I mean,
it's bad manners, but, like, my stomach wouldn't be able to take it. It's rude, but it's just speaks to the coldness to me of these men. You know, their ability to just keep on going.
But Frank didn't need to tell Nabi Saleh. He could have just said, I'm meeting up with someone. Feel free to grab a burger.
Well, from what I'm hearing, he had been, his driving skills had diminished. Yeah. You know, we'll talk about his dementia diagnosis. You know, maybe he needed that help. Maybe he wanted a witness.
Actually, the two or three witnesses gather. There would be some biblical principle there to sign something. Yeah, probably. Bolton was going on about what evidence did Brett Sandstock actually submit, because there was very little on Brett Sandstock's part. And Brett didn't want to tell anyone because, one, he didn't think he'd be believed. But then he got angry when his mother told him. And then next thing you know, Barbara Taylor's involved, Mumford's involved. So when Bolton was grilling Brett Sandstock, one of the things was, what evidence did you submit? Because there's very little of that. We can see you are really relying on your memory. It was out of Brett's league. And from what he knew, it was Barbara Taylor possibly documenting stuff. He was just led to believe that other people were doing something behind the scenes this entire time. Barbara Taylor said, oh, the church will be dealing with this. This needs to be done in-house. Don't go to the police. This will be dealt with in the church. I don't know what he could do, because he was being harassed by Frank Houston behind the scenes. Yeah.
I have had contact with Brett and his incredible wife, Lisa, who's just super cool over the years. And they are the people that you see. That's them. And Brett's a very, very humble man. And his martial arts abilities were mentioned in court this week. I mean, I don't know how many black belts he's got. He's the kind of guy that doesn't talk about that stuff. He's not a big self-promoter. And I found the whole thing really, really hard to watch. I'd never seen a defense barrister cross-examine a child sexual assault survivor like that, or, I mean, much at all in a courtroom. And you read about it, but to see it take place was, it was just like a hacking apart, like, you know, just with a meat cleaver hacking this guy.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the defense's job. He says, you know, I've only got a couple of quotes, but you know, your sequence of events has proved to be a problem for you in the past, hasn't it, since you went to the Royal Commission, you know, like, and I mean, so throw in here as well, Brett is 60. He's survived stage 4 cancer as well, and he was subject to what a defence lawyer would do in this situation, but it was very tough to watch.
I was proud of him taking that stand because he did cop it really sweet and he stood his ground. He said, I stand by what I said. That's what I said at the time. That's what I said.
There was this repeated, where the defence was going, you know,
well, this is just your memory, isn't it?
You had the phone call with Brian Houston and he said, Dick, and Brett said that phone call never happened.
Yeah, he did. Right.
And the defence went, Brian said this, and then Brian said that, and Brian said this, and Brett was like, no.
Mm-hmm.
I know that he's just a hero to so many more people than he'll ever know. And I know a lot of people want to send him strength and love and their gratitude. So fingers crossed, Brett, if you're listening.
And Lisa was there.
Lisa's a legend.
I can't imagine what she was going through watching that happen. So incredible.
I saw him just outside the courtroom after he left the stand after being, you know, doubted and watching the defence trying to confuse him and trick him up and kind of prove that his memory isn't very credible. And the abuse has always been established in this case. That's not in dispute. You know, Frank confessed to having abused Brett. But, you know, in terms of Brett being a credible witness or... So then, yeah, I saw him just outside the courtroom afterwards. He was wearing a mask and I could see that, you know, his eyes were in some pain, and I just walked past him and I said, thank you. And he said, I can't talk to you. And I said, yeah, no, I know, but thank you. And I walked off. So we're hoping this is a good process for them.
I wish I could say something. I didn't know what to say. I wanted to say something.
See, this is the thing. It's so important to try and keep separate from this process and the people and not contaminate it at all. And it's really hard.
Because I didn't know what I could say.
Well, we're going to be able to say a lot more in just some short time. So Brett's testimony finished of the morning of day 2, and then Barbara came in the afternoon.
They mentioned on day 1 that one of the witnesses is coming into a wheelchair.
That's right.
That be? And we found out day 2 it was Barbara Taylor, and it was incredible.
It was Barbara Taylor.
I had no idea. Beautiful moment.
So Brett finished testimony on day 2, and then the how do you describe Barbara Taylor, Jake? Like, we find out she's 90 years old. She is she wasn't in a wheelchair. She walked assisted by somebody to the witness stand. There was some conjecture actually before she testified about whether she wanted legal advice. And the prosecution explained to the magistrate that Ms. Taylor had refused legal advice. She wasn't interested. She didn't care whether her evidence would incriminate her criminally, and she was happy just to give evidence as it came. So Barbara Taylor, as we just said, was the pastor of the small church and the relative of Brett Sengstock's mother and Mother Rose, and the person, one of the people that Rose disclosed to very early in this story about Brett's abuse. And so she had then acted to try and contact the men involved, and the story is very, very interesting over the next 12 months.
When she came into that room, something in my head went, she's still going, oi, because she has been remarkable in being a real dog with a bone in handling Brett from start to finish. When she first heard, I could tell that.
Revival, revival in our hearts. Revival. Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.